Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool.
Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
What do you love about music?
To begin with? Everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Michael Angelakos of Passion Pit disguises soul music as dance pop that can fill arenas around the country. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. Michael Angelakos joins us for a very candid interview and a stripped-down performance. Then, later in the show, Greg and I review the new album from the queen of rockabilly, Wanda Jackson. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Smoking weed down the star projectors. I guess we'll never know what Harvard gets us. But seeing my family have it all took the place of that desire for diplomas on the wall. And really, I think I like who I'm becoming. There's times where I might do it just to do it like it's nothing. There's times where I might blow like 50K on a vacation for all my soldiers just to see the looks on all their faces. All it took was patience. I got a lot of friends to come up off the strip for me. The same ones that'll come up off the hip for me. The realest niggas say your lyrics do shit for me. I told my story and made his story.
That was the hip-hop artist Drake, who is in the news lately because he made more than $3 million in the last year from the streaming internet radio service Pandora. That is a whopping total. Those numbers courtesy of Pandora CEO Tim Westergren, who posted in his blog the other day some fascinating figures countering some of the claims made by artists and record industry pundits that these streaming services really aren't the future of the music industry because the payments are so small. They point out that we've gone from the $18, $19 CD to the $1 download to the pennies, micro pennies per stream as a revenue source for these artists. And Westergren is saying that Pandora, wait a minute, we're actually paying these artists significant amounts of revenue. 55% of the revenue at Pandora goes directly to the artists, Westergren is saying. He pointed out that not only is Drake and Lil Wayne making more than $3 million a year, and artists like Coldplay and Adele, Wiz Khalifa, more than $1 million a year from streaming services, you'd expect that. But he's saying smaller level artists are making decent income as well. More than 2,000 artists on the Pandora service made more than $10,000 in the last year, and more than 800 artists made over $50,000. So a decent middle-class income just from streaming service money alone.
I was like Mom said, you save up your pennies, they add up.
There you go.
seem like it's been ages. And tomorrow's sun, new building, scrape the sky. I love this country dearly. I can feel the ladder clearly. But I never thought I'd be alone to try.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's Passion Pit performing Take a Walk on their latest album, Gossamer. Passion Pit's essentially the brainchild of one man, 25-year-old Michael Angelakos. While based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Angelakos and his band exploded into worldwide success after putting just a few songs up on that old site. Remember MySpace? That's where they started. Fans and critics have latched onto this unique combination of indie rock and dance groups, but I think what really separates the band from a lot of other mainstream success stories is the lyrics. Those dark, introspective lyrics where Angelakos wrestles with personal demons like addiction and mental illness. And that contrast between the light music and the dark lyrics is really what makes Passion Pit so interesting.
Greg, it's a big part of why we gave Gossamer a double buy it back when we reviewed the album in July. Michael Angelakos visited our studios when he was in Chicago for Lollapalooza, and we sat down and had a very frank discussion about where the band is in its career and where he is in his personal life. We started the conversation by going back to the beginning of Passion Pit. Well, Michael, is this story apocryphal or not? You were trying to get a Valentine's Day present together for a woman with whom you were enamored in school. Is this right?
Yeah.
I mean, but, that's so Buddy Holly. That's classic. It's beautiful, man.
I know. And you know what? It's haunted me to this day. Because everyone asks me this. They ask me it the same way. Because it's really hard to, you know, it could easily be fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I just kind of like muttered that to someone. They were like, that's a great story. Mm-hmm. And then that made me really self-conscious. And I started like really getting defensive about it.
Yeah, but man, anybody who's a writer, me or Greg, anybody who's been a musician, anybody who's been a painter, you know, we've been there. We've all done that. Why else do you begin to make art?
But people start questioning it when you start making money off it. Then it becomes your livelihood. And quite frankly, that's totally, I mean, called for. I mean, yeah, people make up stories all the time. It is kind of far-fetched. But it was definitely a little Valentine's Day gift, albeit a late one.
Hmm.
Which is characteristic. It was such a weird, looking back on it now, I don't even know what I was thinking. But I'm quite proud of the fact that I was able to finish something. Hmm. You know, that's the biggest feat of all, finishing something.
I mean, how big of a role was music in your life at this point? Did you see it as something you would do as a way to make a living?
Right. No, I was going to school for media studies, like criticism.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know something about that.
Thank God you skipped that one. You weren't even thinking about playing gigs or making a recording or going to a record company with your music. That was not even on the radar for you.
No. That was brought to me by other people. And quite frankly, I was very hesitant. I was reluctant to even get into it because I thought it was just kind of devaluing the. It was very fun. It was very fun. At one point, it was just fun. And then, yeah, people blew it out of proportion almost. And I kind of got a little self-conscious about it. And then, yeah, then the labels came along. And
wow, what a whirlwind, huh? 1 year of...
Yeah, it was just weird. I mean, it's nice. It's nice. It's very nice. But, mm-hmm. At the same time, it's weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, now at this point, I mean, you'll become above and beyond the musical accomplishments. You know, you're a famous footnote for being one of the first big MySpace, you know, kind of groundswell successes. People discovered this music. Did you put it up there? How did it get up there?
Yes, I did. And I remember the conversation I had with my friend about MySpace where he was like, you need to put your stuff on MySpace. And I was like, only emo bands do that. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't fall into that trap. And I really wasn't interested in making it into this commercial project. I just, it made itself almost, which is, I suppose, the nicest way of it happening.
And ain't it weird to be here now, what, 5 or 6 years later? Like, remember MySpace? Remember what that was?
Well, I can't even believe I'm still playing these songs, is the thing. That's the other thing. Is that I usually would write a song, and then I would write songs for a show, and then the show would be over, mm-hmm. and that would be it. I'd move
and
on.
The songs were over.
Yeah, and that's it. The fact that I'm still playing Sleepyhead is just the most outrageous thing to me.
Well, how did that song in particular... So that's the song that really introduced you
to the vast majority of people, the one that everybody first fell in love with. How did it come together?
That started with the sample, Mary O'Hara's version of Oroma Bahajin. And I just kind of, I mean, I didn't even have it properly locked to a tempo in the program or anything. I didn't even know what I was doing. I just kind of somehow figured out a way to make it work. And I just built the song around it, and I had it in my head, and it, I guess the recording in total was about 2 hours.
Mm, wow.
So, I mean, the song's only 2.5 minutes long. So, again, it just goes, it just, you know, says a lot about the way in which I was working, which is basically just throwing things onto the screen, seeing what worked.
You know, I think the one thing that strikes me about that song, and obviously your music since you've gone along, is you listen to that song now, and it doesn't seem like it's a bedroom recording or this really modest recording as you describe. It sounds like something that you could hear on the radio next to, you know, a Rihanna song or a Kanye West song. It's got these big values in the hooks. Your voice is another thing that's striking about it. It almost seems like it's coming from, for me, when I heard it the first time, I go, who is this new R&B singer? Were you listening to those kind of records, the Rihanna records and Kanye records? Was that having any kind of influence at all in the way that particular recording came out?
Sure. I mean, I've always been a huge pop fan, and I love writing pop songs. Mm-hmm. I've always liked writing pop songs since I was a kid. But those artists, like, you know, radio top 40 artists, they weren't influences, but I certainly liked, I mean, I think the intelligence behind a lot of those songs is definitely undermined by sometimes the artist. But I never really, you know, had any kind of, you know, idea of what I wanted, where I wanted the music to go, or what, you know, what palette I was working with, or, you know, I just kind of naturally have always been writing hook-driven songs. I suppose that top 40 music, and especially Passion Pit music, it kind of culls from those, specifically that world, but it always just does something a little bit to the left to
sure.
just veer out of, it can never just go there.
Right.
I have to like take the long road, you know, where everyone just goes straight over. And I always just make, there's always this really long winding road to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I know what you're talking about. And I think at the end of the day, I've always just liked pop music.
But the sounds are amazing, as you said. I think the production values are way ahead of anything that's being created in the rock spectrum right now. You know, that's the thing that's amazing to me.
I mean, but Kanye has always been someone who's tried to do that. You know, he's mm-hmm. always been, he goes crazy over a kick drum, you
sure.
know? So, I mean, there are people that care. And there are people that don't care, and they just happen to be on the same platform, you know?
The other thing I got to ask you about this early part of your career, you were talking about seriously starting media and, you know, thinking about being a critic or a reporter or a journalist or whatever. But you obviously have some training, or it seems like you have some training. I mean, we just heard you playing, just tinkling around the keyboards here. I go, that guy's had a few lessons or something. He's learned something. And I know the voice. I've heard people say 4 octaves. I mean, is that an mm-hmm. exaggeration?
No.
Where does that come from?
I have no idea. I mean, my father was a music teacher. I was taught guitar for years, but my guitar teacher had to, like, restructure the way he taught me because he saw talent, but I just refused to learn the same way as other people. I guess I'm a bit of a jerk in that sense, but I don't hear things the same way as I can't study things the same way as other people. That's why I didn't go to Berkeley. My parents refused to let me go to music school because they said, well, if you do that, you're going to never want to play music again. You need to have it. It needs to be something that's like your own world. It can't be the only world, you know. And they were ultimately right.
We got this piano here. Are you going to play a song for us?
I think I'm going to play a song for you, yeah.
Now, what are you going to play?
I'm going to play Constant Conversations.
Excellent.
Just staring at the floor, the conversation's moderated by the noisy streets below. I never wanna hurt you, baby. I'm just a mess with a name and a price. But now I'm drunker than before. They told me drinking doesn't make me nice. You never know where some people will. Yes, some people been hurting me. You can tell by look, by the slightest crook in the neck or the blink of an eye. Well, then they'll say what they say and they'll do what they do. Well, that doesn't mean a goddamn thing. You can listen if you want. You can listen if you don't. Yeah, they'll talk. Yeah, they'll even sing. Well, everybody now. Oh, yeah, they're singing through the bright spring leaves. Everybody now, oh, 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 oh. Yeah, they love you when they need you, but someday you're gonna need to find some other kind of place to go. That one of us can think. There's a bump in the road, yeah, you'd fix it. But for me, I just run off the road. But tonight you've got me cornered, and I haven't got a place to go. You never know where some people will go. Yeah, some people been hurting me. You can tell by look, by the slightest crook in the neck or the blink of an eye. Well, then they'll say what they say and they'll do what they do, but that doesn't mean a goddamn thing. And you can listen if you want, you can listen if you don't. Yeah, they'll talk, yeah, they'll even sing. Well, everybody now.
That was Michael Angelakos of Passion Pit playing Constant Conversations live on Sound Opinions We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX with more conversation and another performance from Passion Pit. Then, later in the show, Greg drops a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox. Back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that's a bit of the song Folds in Your Hands by Passion Pit from their first album, Manners. The band's lead singer and founder, Michael Angelakos, joins us in the studio this week. Passion Pit leapt onto the scene a few years ago with the help of MySpace, and they set out on a grueling tour schedule that took them around the world. It was 3 years after the release of that debut, Manners, before Gossamer came along. That can be a lot of time for a buzz band to maintain momentum. So I wondered, what took so long?
I love when people go, and then you had this 3-year hiatus.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking to myself, I toured for about 2.5 of those years.
I never worked harder in my life.
Wait. I didn't tour where you live, but I toured in all these other places. Yeah, no, it was definitely a break for a lot of people, and maybe that it was to our advantage, because gave people a little bit of there's some breathing space.
Did you enjoy that touring?
Yes and no. It was definitely tiresome. At the end of the day, we had a lot of fun. So yeah.
You get to see things you never saw. But can I share the story we just heard?
Sure.
I mean, because this underscores the surreality of the situation you are now in with Passion Pit. So they got this. Did you hear him talking about this?
A little bit, yeah.
They got this gig up in a city to the north, the country to the north of us. And he's, the end of the gig is very close to the time when he's got to fly out. So, they had a choice. It's like, well, we can change the whole schedule, or we can pay $1,000 to get you a police escort to speed to the airport. I mean, you got to feel like a Beatle, man.
For $1,000, yeah.
I would pay $1,000 for that once to have the sirens you're cutting people off.
Well, you saw me. You saw the way that I reacted to that. I thought it was ridiculous, but yeah, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. You said with an absurd look on your face, hell yeah, escort.
I mean, unfortunately, we've had to change around our schedule a lot, and I got to get back home, and I definitely want to make that flight, so...
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a doctor's appointment at 6 a.m., so, you got to do what you have to do.
So you're making these records. They're pretty private affairs, I get. I know that I think Manners was made with you and one other band member, right, mm-hmm. basically. The EP, obviously, was your thing. Gossamer was pretty much a solo record, from what I can gather. And then you take it out and play in front of, potentially tens of thousands of people, as you will, on Lollapalooza weekend here. What's more satisfying to you?
I always look at it as though there are two different types of Passion Pit. There's the studio Passion Pit, and there's the live Passion Pit. And
each passion pit serves a completely different purpose. In the studio, it's a very, very drawn out affair. It is very insular. Sometimes it's a lot of fun, and other times it's really makes you want to pull your hair out. But but yeah, no, I think what's happened is that we realize that people really react in a live setting. And I've grown to really love the live audience quite a bit because it's so the way that the vocal sound itself works is it's kind of begging for audience participation, you know? And so when people are singing along to all these songs, I mean, the lyrics may be a little harrowing or whatever, but when they sing along, sonically it works so well. And it's just, it's so overwhelming and emotional for me. And people really, there's this communal, it's much more communal than you would ever think. And so it's just a whole other world that you enter when you get on stage. It's not like you're performing for someone, you're performing with people.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. We're here with Passion Pit, Michael Angelakos. And Michael, that's a great point about the celebration that goes with this music, because I think if you listen to it on a surface level, it is celebratory. It's up. You know, there's a feeling of anthemic quality to the music. And you wonder sometimes, like, I wonder if they're really paying attention to what they're singing along with, you know, especially some of these recent songs. I'm wondering if you're thinking, yeah, some of the, yeah, as you said, some of the stuff is pretty harrowing. Do you feel like there's a disconnect there?
Well, when we reviewed it, Michael, before you answered, you know, we called it soul music. I mean, I think that's all great soul music, you know, is that sometimes the lyrics are coming from a dark place, but the music is about uplift.
I've tried to separate myself from it. And what I'm representing with the music is, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be reflected in the performance, for instance. But it is pretty dark music, and I've always just written that kind of music. Particularly this record got pretty dark. I think that's probably one of the best parts about it, is that somehow we're able to bring people in even with that mentality. It's as though, you know, there's no director's commentary. I'm not going to sit there and explain every single song to everyone. I don't really need to. The point is that it there's a lot of imagery. There are a lot of different kinds of sentiments being talked about on the record, and people will take it in so many different ways. And I think at the end of the day, when you bring it to a live situation, that's all leveled out. And it's just this onslaught of emotion.
See, he was saying before he didn't want to be emo, but he wound up emo. you're emoer than emo, man.
Yeah, but the emo guys make you feel depressed because the music sounds depressing, and I think
I get depressed when I listen to most emo. Yeah,
you know, here are these great pop anthems that, like, again, if you just tuned out, you know, every word, you would think, man, like I said, it belongs on a radio next to Rihanna or Katy Perry. And then if you really pay attention to what's going on, it's like this whole other level where you're going, oh.
But the juxtaposition is very important because the euphoria is supposed to be blended in with the terrible, depressive, you know, content. But that euphoria is something that I've always latched onto. I've always loved writing, you know, and Passion Pit's been a great vehicle for it. So I've just kept going with it. The second records are funny. Everyone always asks about the second record and what you do with a second record, and you know, do you do a congratulations like MGMT, where they were like, we're going to be ourselves, we're going to do what we want to do, this is it. And I think the record's great. Of course, it turned off a lot of fans of their earlier work because it's a lot different. I thought that it was the next step for Passion Pit was just to amplify everything by, you know, a great number. It's something that I've always, I didn't want to stray from the sound. I just wanted to build upon it. And at the end of the day, I think
pop music is not something that has to necessarily be, you don't necessarily need to, like you were saying, write lyrics that match the music. And that's what so many people are used to, I suppose, you know? Like, yeah. There's this type of song, these kind of lyrics that go with it. I've always found the dichotomy to be the most interesting part.
Well, it's like it's a string swelling scene in the movie where, you know, the woman is dying of cancer at the end and the strings swell and they're like jamming this emotion down your face. Like, you're supposed to cry now because this music is telling you. And your music is kind of sending, it's not telling you how to feel. There's many things you could be feeling at that.
Well, life
is
really confusing. Mm-hmm. Life is a really confusing thing. And I always have, there's never just one emotion you're feeling. There's usually a slew of emotions. And I try to make that as overwhelming as possible with passion pit music. And I've always loved the juxtaposition. I've always thought that was just what worked. Mm-hmm. So I kept going with it.
It reminds me a lot of Nick Drake in that way, especially the first two albums. The music is so uplifting, but he's often singing about being in a dark place. And by the time he records his last album, he can't get up off the studio floor even to stand in front of the mic, you know. Yeah. But the music is beautiful, and the words are dark, but then they also hint at light.
Right.
Is there a little of that happening here, or am I just going off the rock critic ledge?
Both.
I think every guest we have should be a media studies expert.
Yes.
I it's really nice that you bring that up. I think that that's the point. That's the point of the record. That's really the point of it. And I mean, I went into it with a point in mind. And some people just like putting together a collection of songs. This was a painstaking process, and I wanted it to be a solid body of work.
But it sounds like, if I may say this, it sounds like a very obsessive record in a lot of ways, because I heard stories about 120 tracks of music being filled up, and it's very layered.
That's just what Pro Tools would allow. Yeah. We had over 200 for almost each track. It was insane. And then we just parsed through and figured out what worked.
Did you ever feel like I've completely gone through the rabbit hole now? I don't know. There's so much music here.
All the time. And I'm told all the time. It's about learning. And, you know, I haven't made many records in my lifetime, so like this. So, you know, I'm just learning what works and what doesn't work, and, you know, and what my limitations are and when to draw the line. And, you know, I'm 25 years old. I think it's fun to make mistakes and figure out what you want to do from that point, and be able to kind of go overboard and bring it back. Mm-hmm. That's a lot more fun than the other way around.
Well, did it help to be working somewhere else? I mean, because you know My Bloody Valentine, Kevin Shields, right? He was a genius, makes a brilliant album in 1991, and we haven't had new music since. You know, takes a big advance from a record company, builds a studio in his house, and never leaves. You know, you at some point were going to get kicked out of that studio in New York when, you know, they stop paying the bills. So there's a little bit of an element there. I can't go too obsessive here, because the clock is ticking.
I also had a label that was pretty anxious, because I wouldn't show them demos. Because the way Passion Pit songs work, if I showed you a demo, you'd have no idea what the song sounded like. Because it's not complete. It has to be complete. And so imagine a label dealing with that. I mean, I felt pretty bad by the end of it, because during the making of it, I was just like, leave me alone, you know?
Yeah.
But they were so patient, and they let me kind of do my thing. They knew that eventually I'd figure it out. And you can't really say that they do that for many artists. So, again, I'm utterly grateful for everything that I have. I'm an extraordinarily lucky artist. So.
Cool. How about another song, Michael?
Sure. I'll do I'll play Sleepyhead. Thank you.
And you said it was like fire on the brim, burning solid, burning thin, the burning rim, like stars burning holes right through the dark, flicking fire like salt water into my eyes. You were 1 inch from the edge of this bed.
Beautiful stuff. That's Sleepy Head from Passion Pit on Sound Opinions, Michael Angelakos. Boy, you should do a whole album like that, man. I've heard two songs with you at the piano, and your songs, I would imagine they start in a similar place, very stripped down, before they become these built-up things. But is that true? Pretty much just you and the piano?
Sometimes. I'll Be Alright was just guitar and vocals mm-hmm. first, and then, but a lot of times it'll be full production.
Mm-hmm.
Everything will come together all at once.
So you have a sort of an orchestrated idea already in your head as you're writing the song.
Yeah, most of my songs come to me just the whole song, and mm-hmm. then I just kind of have to interpret it somehow.
Well, we got to ask you, you canceled a few dates, mental health issues. And the question I got the most when I mentioned to people that you were coming on the show for the last couple of weeks, how's he feeling? How's Michael feeling?
You know, it's just really bad timing. I'm feeling much better, but, you know, it's always, it's a constant uphill battle. I've been dealing with manic depression since I was about 17 years old, and it's just gotten worse and worse. And it's something that is the root of a lot. You can hear it in a lot of the songs. Even the whole Passion Pit mechanism is kind of manic depressive. But I'm feeling better. It's just going to take a little bit of time to fully adjust and get to a place where I feel like I'm able to dive headfirst into it again. I haven't been touring very much, and it's a lot. It's a lot to tour, and it's a lot for people to talk about you, and it's a lot for people to have opinions about what you do. And I'm a really sensitive person. Like, you know, most artists, you know, they don't like to say it, but they do care about what people think. And I wasn't hiding or anything. I'm not hiding by canceling the shows. I had to do what was right, what was recommended. And what was recommended was that I needed to take some time for myself and get the proper help while I could before everything was full swing. So like anyone, I mean, a lot of people deal with this.
A lot of people do, and I just think, you know, thank you for talking about it the way you've been doing it, because it doesn't get talked about a lot. People are certainly never as frank as you've been, not only with us, but in other interviews, and I think it's really valuable.
Talking about it is so unbelievable. I wasn't really allowed to talk about it until much later in my life. Mm. So the fact that I'm now, I just don't see how else I can really go about living without talking about it. I mean, because it's greatly affecting my life. And instead of lying, making up stories and lying about it, or, you know, kind of circumventing the whole issue, it's a lot easier for me to just say it. And actually, you know, hopefully someone somewhere
benefits from it in some way. And, you know, there are still things I'd like to keep to myself. But it's you know, when people buy tickets to your shows and or they buy your album and they invest in you as an artist, they deserve an explanation. And that's the only reason I really opened up about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting, too, because the one message I get, you know, I think Jim and I kind of came to the same conclusion about the record. When I hear those uplifting songs and I started really processing what's going on in the lyrics, I'm going, man, this is, you know, it's a tough listen in some ways. But the message I got out of it was a sense of resilience. And I'm wondering, you know, it's a cliche in a way, you know, music is therapy, but it seems like it's a healthy outlet for you to be able to do this and express yourself in this way.
It's certainly a lot healthier than other means of dealing with it. Mm. And it always has been, but I've never dealt with it in such a direct way. This record particularly was very direct. And also now I'm not so afraid to talk about it. And the weight that is lifted when you do that, when you finally just admit that this is what you go through and this is what you have to deal with. And people do understand and it makes your life a lot easier, and you keep being told like to keep it a secret and don't talk about it. But at the end of the day, the record is triumphant. I'm alive. I'm talking to you right now. I think I just played two songs for you.
pretty good record.
Yeah. I finished the record, and I'm still with my fiance. I'm still working on all these things in my life instead of giving up, and I'm still touring. That's a triumph for me. You know, for some people that's a given, mm-hmm. but no, that's actually a really big deal, and I'm really proud of myself for pushing through it and finding a way to get to that point, get to this exact point. This is a big deal for me.
Well, it's a big deal for us having you here, and we can't thank you enough for coming in, Michael Angelakos of Passion Pit. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
To see video of Michael Angelakos performing Passion Pit songs, visit soundopinions.org. To comment on this interview or anything we do on the show, give us a call at 888-859-1800. After a short break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, Jim and I review the new collaboration between Wanda Jackson and Justin Townes Earl. Then I drop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He is Greg Kot, and that is the voice of Wanda Jackson covering California Stars. Greg, you know that as the song that Woody Guthrie wrote the lyrics, and then years later, Billy Bragg and Wilco finished the tune. Who is Wanda Jackson? She is the queen of rockabilly, a goddess to American roots music fans. She was midway through high school in 1954 in Oklahoma City when a record label heard her singing on the radio and said, "This girl is a star." Indeed, she became one,
all throughout the 50s, touring with her brand of rockabilly, in some cases opening for Elvis Presley. And she had a big hit with a song that Elvis had initially covered, Let's Have a Party. She had an even bigger hit than he had. She kept busy all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. She's never really stopped. Now she's 74 years old, and she's having a late career renaissance. In 2011, Jack White produced a big comeback album, The Party Ain't Over. Now we have her doing a follow-up, Unfinished Business, working with another young producer and big fan, Justin Townes Earl, the son of singer-songwriter Steve Earl. A few originals on here, a lot of covers, some interesting choices. Etta James, Bobby Womack. This song we're going to play next, Tore Down, is a cover by the Texas bluesman Freddie King. Here is Wanda Jackson from Unfinished Business on Sound Opinions.
To the river to jump in. My baby showed up and said, I'll tell you when. I'm tore down, almost level with the ground. But I feel like this when my baby ain't around. I love you, babe, with all my heart and soul. Love like mine will never grow old. Love you in the morning and in the evening too. Every time you leave me, I get mad with you. And I'm tore down, almost level with the ground. But I feel like this when my baby can't be found.
That is Tore Down from Wanda Jackson and her latest album, Unfinished Business. Jim, you mentioned that she worked with one of her fans, Jack White, on her 2011 album, The Party Ain't Over. And all good words toward Jack White. But, you know, every time Jack gets involved with a record, it ends up sounding a little bit like a Jack White record, more than maybe the artist that he's working with. In that case, I think he sort of took over a little bit and put Wanda in some places where she didn't necessarily want to go. Some of the Caribbean flourishes, some of the horn charts, you know.
I gave it a trash it when we reviewed it on the show.
I wasn't particularly fond of that record. Justin Townes Earl kind of brings her back to her roots. You know, you got to know that Wanda Jackson was well steeped in not only early rock and roll, but country music, and later on she did a fine turn in gospel. She's very conversant with these styles. I think that version of California Stars that she does indicates that she wasn't really feeling those lyrics. She's going, you know, this really isn't my stuff. But most of this record really works. I think Tore Down, The Graveyard Ship, Pushover, songs of that ilk really show her wild rockabilly side. Remember, she's like a proto-Riot Girl in some ways. She was a proto-feminist rocker before that became the vogue decades later. Also, the way she inhabits a ballad like Am I Even a Memory? At 74, Wanda, you are not a memory. You are still a very vital performer. I give this a buy it rating.
Craig, I wish I could be as enthusiastic as you are. I admire Wanda Jackson enormously. I've made this observation in the past. We are awash in young producers, young singer-songwriters, going back to heroes and reworking what they did best back in the day. Sometimes it works. I really like Damon Albarn's recent collaboration with Bobby Womack. More often, it doesn't. Justin Townes Earl did a better job than Jack White, never thought I'd say that, making a feistier record, a more Wanda Jackson appropriate record. But to me, it never really catches fire. You know, I don't know whether the situation is she really has to go back to classic retro 50s or whether she should go way forward and actually front a Riot Girl band. I'd really like to hear what that would sound like. I couldn't honestly say to someone new to Wanda Jackson that there weren't three or four of her classic albums that they should go to first. I don't want to discount it entirely, though, so I'll give it a burn it.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Just a castaway, island lost at sea. Now I'm stranded on my own.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Sandy, I'm so fucking home. Sandy, yeah, I'm on my own. Sandy, you gotta leave me alone, cause I'm Sandy.
That introductory music can only mean that it is time for one of us to hop in the submarine and take a trip to the desert island. Mr. Cott, it's your turn to give us a song you can't live without.
Thank you, Jim. The election is on everybody's mind, the presidential election, a big one coming up in a few weeks, and my thoughts turn to the great band X out of Los Angeles, writing what I think is one of the definitive songs about the meaning of a presidential election.
Or in maybe the Reagan era, right?
Yeah, or maybe the lack of meaning in some cases. This is a track I'm going to play from their fourth album, More Fun in the New World, I think one of their best albums. The leadoff track is called The New World. And in this song, they take the perspective of a homeless person. This was the era of trickle-down economics. This was the era of the Cold War, the era of imminent nuclear annihilation, or at least that's the way some of us felt. And the thought that among the lowest of the low, the people at the very bottom of the economic spectrum, it didn't matter who was running the country because things weren't going to change. X was brilliant at addressing these sort of social issues in their songs. I'm talking about guitarist Billy Zoom. Remember that spectacular smirk he used to always wear on stage
while he was playing guitar? I'm still scared of that guy.
DJ Bonebreak, an amazing drummer. And then the two songwriters, John Doe and Exene Cervenka, just did a marvelous job of distilling the feeling that was in the air in that 80s Reagan era for the have-nots. You know, there was the haves and the have-nots, and they were writing for the have-nots. That is clearly the message they're sending with this song, a bleak Election Day song, but also in some ways affirming, because it says, you know what, at the end of the day, don't forget the Motor City, invoking Martha and the Vandellas, that celebratory song, and saying, you know what, don't forget about us. There's still hope amid the ruins. This is X with The New World on Sound Opinions.
That is The New World by X, Greg Kot's Desert Island Jukebox pick, and a fine one it was, GK. The Sound Opinions Desert Island Jukebox is supported by Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark Bourbon, it is what it isn't. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to make your head explode. We've got a live performance from Ty Siegel.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Adam Yaffe helped with our recording. Sound Opinions is produced by Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. Our assistant producer is Annie Minoff, and our intern is Griffin Waterman. Cannot forget our fearless leader, our executive producer, our very own sleepyhead, Tori Southside Malatia.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hi there, this is Dustin from Washington State. About your review of the new XX album, I kind of agree. I like the XX a lot. They've got a brilliant intensity to them, and they're so subdued. It's just a bit much. It's almost like I listen to it when I want to go to sleep and be in a good mood, and that's fine.
Come realize, why do I refuse you? 'Cause if my fear's right, I risk to lose you.
I just think if they could just occasionally just whip up a bit of a frenzy at the end of some of these songs, and I know they can. I think they've got the talent to. It would be so dramatic. They disappoint me when they don't do that. They enjoy what they're doing, but I hope they wake up a bit. That would make it a bit more better for me, anyways. Love the show. Thank you very much.
And we're not together.
My name's Chris. I just wanted to comment that I love Mumford & Sons' new album, Babel, and I just have to respectfully disagree with the opinion on the air. I love that it has religious undertones, but is not evangelical as Marcus Mumford was raised, because I think the average fan, like myself, is not overly religious. There's some amazing stories in the Bible, like you guys just mentioned, but I think that the stories themselves are not as powerful as the messages of those stories, which they use in their music. So keep up the good work. Bye.
Whispers in the dark, steal a kiss, and you'll break your heart. Pick up your clothes and curl your toes, learn your lesson, lead me home. Spare my sins for the ark. I was too slow to depart. I'm a cad, but I'm not a fraud. I'd set out to serve the Lord.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Kenny from Palm Desert, California. Every once in a while, you guys make me so mad, and I just wanted to call and tell you how wrong you are about the new Mumford & Sons. You picked the strangest times to get picky about lyrics, and I know other listeners have called you out on it before, but you did it last year with Coldplay, too, their new album, and I took your word for it on that album, and I stayed away from it, and then I kept hearing it around. Every time I wondered, hey, that sounds good, who was that? I'd look, and it'd be the new Coldplay album. The music is good, and, you know, not to be too plebeian about the whole thing, but sometimes lyrics just don't matter. The new Mumford & Sons has great music, great beats, great harmonies, great instrumentation, but I just wanted to let your other listeners know, don't listen to Jim and Greg on this one. Go get the new Mumford & Sons. The music is great, even though the lyrics may be stupid. Thanks, guys.
I still believe, though there's cracks you'll see. When I'm on my knees, I still believe. And when I've hit the ground, neither lost nor found. If you believe in me, I still believe.
Hey, guys. This is Jamie from Milwaukee. You know, I don't totally disagree with your take on the Mumford & Sons, but here's how I liken it to the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon. It may be awful and trite and boring, but people are reading, and that's important. And I think the same thing goes for the Mumford & Sons record. You know, it may not be the best record out there, and it may not be the best folk rock record that's out there, but at least people are listening to something different, so that maybe, you know, next year when the newest Nickelback or somebody awful's record comes out, that people may take a different task and not get that awful Nickelback record because they've at least experienced something a little bit different, even though it's not great. I mean, not everyone can be Grizzly Bear, right, guys? All right, take it easy.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool. Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.